Kia ora, Dee from Waipa District Libraries. Thanks for joining us. In today's podcast, we're again looking at heritage and history, and today we're looking at Te Ao Mutu. This comes from Frontier Town, History of Te Ao Mutu, 1884 to 1984, by Laurie Barber. And this comes from the conclusion. Some would say that the need of a city is to accelerate growth, or the desire of a small town is to retain it. Metropolitan life requires high-rise office space, imposing civic amenities, and concrete and steel edifices to witness to the power of multinationals. Small town life neither requires nor values these monuments to passing commercial conquests. Indeed, small town life tends to minimise change by directing its residents and visitors to enduring focal points that stress the stability and quiescence of existence, to the same post office grandfather queued outside to receive the dole during the Great Depression, to the same church where mother and father were married, and to the same school where Uncle Bill was ducks. But does the consistency and almost cyclic repetitiveness of borough life narrow perspective and induce a more polished set of prejudices and a fiercer bigotry than that possessed by the city dweller? Were the voters of Te Ao Mutu in the 1880s very different in aspiration and reaction to the promises made to those of Christchurch? Did Te Ao Mutu's contingent of Massey Cossacks vary much from the Auckland City Special Constables in their distaste for socialists, strikers and syndicalists in 1913? Were the motives of Te Ao Mutu volunteers for the armed forces in 1939 substantially different from those of volunteers from Wellington and Dunedin? In all cases, the answer appears to be no. Christchurch and Te Ao Mutu voters in the 1880s sought an improved economy, the development of profitable markets, and local roading and bridging improvements. Law and order patriotism prompted city dweller Bernard Freyberg to enlist as a special constable in 1913 with the same eagerness as Te Ao Mutu's Colonel Ryder. And in 1939, the same mixture of motivation, patriotism, desire to escape Antipodean boredom, a search for adventure, and a sense of duty was reflected in country, town, and city. If this is so, then has Te Ao Mutu been but Auckland, writ small throughout its century of municipal life? It has not. From its beginnings, Auckland stood as a Pākehā ghetto within a Māori-dominated territory. While Otofeo, Te Ao Mutu, from its first years of culture contact, became a frontier whereon Western farming technology and Western religio-cultural beliefs battled with the traditional patterns of Māori life. In the 1860s, these battles developed into armed conflict and Te Ao Mutu became the southern frontier of British military power in New Zealand. As the land-hungry Pākehā settlers moved south in the post-war years, Te Ao Mutu became the frontier railhead for a rail connection that would open the interior of the island and allow access to the last preserve of unconquered Māoridom. From the late 19th century, the town district became the frontier for intensive grassland farming and for the development of dairying in the Waikato region. Surely this frontiersman and frontierswoman existence has developed qualities of lifestyle and personality quirks dissimilar to the lifestyle and attitudes of New Zealand city dwellers. In American frontier legend, heroes were always enterprising, somewhat uncouth, as honest as the day is long, and unwilling to ascribe to invalid precedents. Te Ao Mutu's heroes were something like that. Dr. Lindsay Rogers, a hero of World War II who joined the Yugoslav partisans, was a man of enterprise who left his town to challenge the Nazi menace in Europe and to become a legend in his own lifetime. Some of the founding father town board commissioners were uncouth in speech and manners, but they were determined to build a town, complete school, post office, churches and town hall, and they kept their shoulders to the wheel until they attained their object. As for unwillingness to compromise to the precedent of the past, no matter how tempting to conform, Marilyn Waring, Te Ao Mutu's Member of Parliament, 1975 to 84, has daringly challenged the conservative base of the party she subscribes to in the interests of reform, natural justice, and the future. It could well be that the borough's heroes reflected and reflect traditional frontier qualities. Does it necessarily follow that several generations of townsfolk have developed similar qualities? Alas, it does not. For most of the town's existence, there have been easy and regular links with much of the Auckland province, and from the first decade of the 20th century with the rest of the North Island. Job mobility from community to community, allowed by this developed transport system, has resulted in only a few families remaining, generation following generation within Te Awamutu. For those without roots or with only a few laterals lightly covered by Te Awamutu earth, there is no distinctive character to their life in this town. They might just as well reside in Waikikumuka or in Shannon, the author's hometown. To misuse some words by Richard Hoggart, it could be said of them that they belong to a great sea of undifferentiated porridge where all the crucial characteristics and the guiding features have been obliterated. And on that note, it's time for a short break. Back soon. And welcome back. We're just continuing on about some comments from Richard Hoggart. Hoggart's comment provides the clue as to what can make for a distinctive Te Awamutu and frontier character. It is a sense of the possession of roots, of identity, of individual belongingness within a community whose history is your history, whose past is sufficiently rich that it endows a future. It is only townsfolk with a sense of history and a sense of belonging within a historical framework who react positively to criticism of their municipality. The transient would have brushed aside a letter dribbling with complaint published in July 1911. It reads, "As a visitor to your town, may I say how delighted I am to note its rapid growth. As a stranger, might I ask if you have any local authority to look after the roads and footpaths? From a look at them at the present time, I should say that they are left to look after themselves. How do you people get about in the dark? Or do you all stay at home after sunset? If you have a local body, they ought to get to work at once." They did get to work at once, because they were not transients, but men and women who claimed the town as their own, and who inherited the dreams of the town's founders that a compact, well-roaded, well-lit, churched and schooled borough should emerge from the blood and dust of its frontier past. Not every historical inheritance brought to Te Awamutu in the trunks and hatboxes of the founders was an unmixed blessing. Ex-officers, the municipality's business leaders, and the town clerics, doctors and lawyers assumed the leadership role played by their class in Britain. The bank clerk and the schoolmaster wore a distinctive garb to symbolise their station, with stiff collars, bowler hats, walking sticks or umbrellas. Local doctors lived in style even when townsfolk did not pay their bills. This group, in the 1870s and 1880s, brought to Te Awamutu and historic class consciousness that made it difficult for their wives to meet on a plane of social equity with a railway porter's wife or a stable hand's wife. However, by the close of World War I, the sharing of economic and wartime vicissitudes, the closeness of small town life and participation in town social activities eroded the sense of superiority. Luckily for the borough, this group retained its sense of duty in the field of leadership, even after deference and class consciousness had disappeared. History had provided the town with recognised leaders, but without aristocrats. Most newcomers to the town in the 1890s were from a middle class imbued with a keen desire for self-improvement and the social betterment of their children. It is hardly surprising then that these ratepayers and residents saw to it that a well-stocked library was quickly built within the town and hardly surprising that they persistently lobbied for better educational facilities for their children. Most Te Awamutu homes at the turn of the 20th century had on their bookshelf at least the minimum of the Bible, a dictionary, a collection of poetry, a novel or two, and several works of an improving nature. Newspapers were read and reread, and even before the inaugural meeting of the first town board, a provincial newspaper was available, and from 1911, a district newspaper with a balance of international, national, and local comment provided residents with a diet of news that helped them maintain a sense of perspective. In frontier America, life was frequently lonely, and to ease the sense of isolation that pervaded, opportunity for community social gatherings were grasped eagerly. This situation was paralleled in early Te Awamutu. Town hall dances were boisterous and earthy. Weddings were times for drinking and unsubtle jokes. Many men joined the volunteers in the 1880s for similar reasons to those who join Rotary or Lions clubs today, for fellowship and joint participation in a worthwhile fraternity. School concerts were given prominence beyond the competence of those who sang and recited in them. Funerals, church fairs, and harvest festivals were valued as much as social occasions as for their religious and ecclesiastical worth. Probably the most historically conscious and the most formalised of the social forces to come to Te Awamutu was religion. From 1900, the churches were particularly concerned with saving frontier towns from irreligious barbarism, and each denomination of any size competed for its share of frontier town adherents. While more than half of Te Awamutu's residents usually absented themselves from public worship on Sunday, these absentees valued Christianity sufficiently to want baptism and were applicable confirmation for their children and a Christian burial for the dead. Clerics acted as modern guardians over the young community and used the sanction of public disapproval against offenders. The trivia and repetition of town life became more tolerable to devotees who believed that God watched over them and that the performance of their boring daily chores was to His glory and perhaps to their eternal reward. The churches invested far more in Te Awamutu than they received monetarily in return. Just going to have another short break and we'll be back again soon. Welcome back. From time unrecorded, humans bound in communities have engaged in sport, and Te Awamutu has been no exception. Māori and Pākehā met at the races whilst racial tension was still fierce in the years following the invasion of the Waikato. Te Whaio, the king, was given free seating and one of Te Kuti's wives won a dividend. Badminton, basketball, cricket, rugby football, polo, hunting, bicycling, athletics, gymnastics, bowling, croquet, tennis and latterly basketball, netball and squash have played their part in maintaining the fitness and social integration of Te Awamutu's residents. Te Awamutu's history has been enriched at one stage or another by each of these groups, the leaders, the aspiring middle class, the promoters of social gatherings, the churches and the athletes. It has also been enriched by a group of whom next to nothing is recorded and whose exploits are still ignored by historians. The great majority who quietly go to work, marry, have families, who retire and die, leave few records, and those few are usually destroyed by their remaining family. Because they do not write to the press, never throw stones at visiting politicians, and because they maintain their anonymity, this work cannot tell of their hopes, dreams and fears. On behalf of all those who will prepare and write this town's bicentennial history, I offer the hope that researchers will interview and record the views and reflections of a cross-section of this expanding group year by year. This book concludes with the firm claim that it is a sense of history, of identification with the past, that makes a resident of Te Awamutu give of time and talent for Te Awamutu's future. For this frontier town, the next 100 years should mark changes almost impossible to envisage. The centenary concluded this year, began with a horse and buggy and ends with satellites, space shuttles and cloning. It began with muskets and Tai Aha and ends with a clear capability that could destroy human life on this planet. Within the limited parameters of Barra life, wonder, fear and prayer are the most common reactions to this explosion in human ingenuity. Perhaps there should be another. A community that values its past as Te Awamutu does should assure that it has a future. The challenge for leadership by desperate nation and world does not stop at city boundaries. Who better to cross the new frontier of the 21st century with creative leadership than those bred in and alive to stable and principled small town traditions? Te Awamutu is a small borough, not anxious to become a city, but there is nothing to prevent it exercising a moral and creative leadership well beyond its size. There is no shame in being raised in a small borough. Stability, a sense of belonging to a worthwhile past, and a faith in the future should equate with being Te Awamutu bred. It is not surprising that the borough's present-day most famous son, Tim Finn of Split Ends fame, sings with pride, "I was born in Te Awamutu." Well, what a lovely way to end our podcast for today. I hope you've enjoyed it. Kia ora.